Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the week in politics as President Trump calls for unity while doubling down on his demand for a wall. Also, the Green New Deal.
Our energy future will not be found in the dark of a mine, but in the light of the sun.
And as Elizabeth Warren prepares to launch a White House bid, she can't seem to shake the controversy around her claims of Indian ancestry.
I am not a member of a tribe, and I have apologized for not being more sensitive to that distinction.
It's all part of our week in review. Also today, the sibling owners of Mei Mei Restaurant on the double awesomeness of Chinese-American food.
The double awesome really, I think, for us is about our Chinese-American heritage. We grew up here in Boston. We ate Chinese food at home. We didn't know it was Chinese food. We thought it was just food.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Happy Friday, everybody. And because it's Friday, the end of a busy week in politics, let's jump right into our week in review.
In the past, most of the people in this room voted for a wall, but the proper wall never got built. I will get it built.
In his State of the Union address, President Trump called for unity and also doubled down on his demand for a wall on the southern border. Massachusetts Democrats in Congress pushed back.
We are not going to support the wall. It is bad policy.
Does the president actually want border security, or does he just want to make a political point by being able to point to a wall that's a waste of money and won't work?
And I thought his statements on immigration really were packed with lies. I mean, it wasn't fact-based.
I don't feel like unity is a muscle that this president has.
With a deadline just a week away to prevent another government shutdown, lawmakers are reportedly close to a deal on border security that would give the president some of what he's demanding. Will he accept it? Let's turn now to our Week in Review panel. With me in the studio, Susan Tracy, the president of the Democratic consulting firm, The Strategy Group. She's also a former state rep. Great to see you, Susan.
Thanks, Anthony.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. Also with us, Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Ed, good to have you here as well. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, good to be back.
So let me start with this coming out of the State of the Union situation here. Lawmakers are still negotiating with the president. I'm reading in various reports out of Washington that they might be close to a deal. Susan, how are you seeing this shaking down? Do you think another shutdown can be avoided?
I do. I don't think there'll be a shutdown. I don't think there'll be a national emergency declared. I think, they'll come up with a plan to have some money to fix up and maybe expand some barriers. And they'll put some money in to reduce the number of detention beds. There'll be some money for technology. And the president will declare victory. That's what I think.
Yeah, what do you think, Ed?
Yes, I agree with that. This morning at the gym, I was watching Fox and Friends soften the language from the wall to border funding. And that's a pretty good indication of where Trump supporters will be led. I agree that we're going to see a deal pretty soon.
Right. So does that mean that, how does Trump spin this as a victory? Because he'll get some of what he wants, or he'll just say the wall is being built?
Well, if you feel no burden to be honest, it's easy to spin things. He can just tell his supporters the wall, which he's been saying has been under construction for weeks, he can tell them the wall is finished and they would believe it. So I think my guess is that he will claim that the money is there, they'll get security, and the wall will eventually be built. He doesn't have to tell the truth in his own mind, don't forget.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Well, go ahead, Susan.
No, I completely agree. I think, when you're making it up, you can make up a victory.
So this week we spoke with, as we heard in those clips in the introduction, a number of members of Massachusetts congressional delegation. So here's Seth Moulton on Radio Boston talking to us, saying that Democrats are at the negotiating table, but he's worried about what the president expects.
Will he accept real border security, even if it's not the political wall that he wants? And will he actually live up to the terms of a deal that's negotiated with him?
I mean, maybe we've moved past that, as we mentioned in the last comment, Susan. I mean, it does look like they're moving close to a deal. But Do you think, are both parties, I guess, negotiating in good faith? I guess that's the question.
I think in Congress they are. I think both sides want to get this done. They have different agendas, obviously. But I think, they want to get it done. There's always this risk that Trump changes his mind at the last minute. It happens repeatedly. But my gut tells me on this one, if he loses the Senate, he's got nowhere to go. And I think he will need to declare victory.
But what happens if Ann Coulter, or the folks on Fox and Friends sort of say he's caved in? What's going to happen?
Well, I think he has other sources of advice, I think, that will tell him that he was really taking a hit in his base in terms of the effects of the shutdown. I think he's concerned about his popularity, his ability to stand up to whatever is going to happen with Congress and with Bob Mueller's report. I don't think he's willing to sacrifice any more popularity because of the commentators. I think he wants to survive.
Yeah. So speaking of his base, we also heard from Massachusetts Republican State Committee member Tom Mountain of Newton on our show this week. He's a big supporter of President Trump. And I want to play a bit of this exchange between him and Democratic strategist and president of the Liberty Square Group, Scott Fersen, because it was emblematic of sort of how this debate sometimes turns into just people talking past each other. So first you're going to hear Tom Mountain.
We're primarily concerned with building the wall. Everything else can come afterwards, negotiable. But building the wall, that is the key element to his presidency. It must be done, and it will be done, with or without the Democrat Congress.
That's not a compromise. If you do yours first and then get to what the Democrats get, that's not compromise.
Well, it is. It is compromise because we're willing to talk about these issues after we secure our border. We have to secure our border first.
I'm for democracy unless I get my way, and then I'm going to do it. That's not compromise.
Susan, what do you hear in that exchange? I mean, this idea that, there really does seem to be this issue of, among Trump's hardest core supporters, this issue of the wall must come first before we can even talk about anything else.
Well, what I think is interesting in that is it leaves out the second part of the wall, which is Mexico is supposed to pay for it. Mm. And I think you fundamentally change the dynamic of this wall when suddenly you tell the taxpayers they're on the hook for it. So sort of standing up to that seems to me the right place to be.
Yeah. What do you hear in that, Ed?
Well, it's always a pleasure to hear from our Republican State Committee members. I agree. It doesn't sound like compromise. I think that Tom isn't realizing that, pushing for this wall, which the country doesn't want, is just hurting Trump's popularity and will prevent anything else he wants from happening.
Right. There was also a call in his speech for more unity. It seemed to, on the one hand, there was this call for unity. On the other hand, he was doubling down on the wall. But Susan, do you think there was an opportunity there? I mean, was that Trump acknowledging that, yes, he's got to deal with divided government, which he didn't really have to do during the first 2 years of his presidency?
I'd answer a couple of ways. On the lead up to the speech, he was tweeting about Schumer. And as soon as the speech ended, he was tweeting against Schiff. And I feel like he talks about unity and he reads words, but his entire kind of demeanor plays to 40% of the country over and over again. And for a guy who lost the popular vote and had a tremendous loss in the 2018 cycle in the House, I just feel like those are not the actions of someone who says, oh, wait a minute, we've got to divide a country. I got to bring this place together.
Right. Ed, did you hear anything that resembled a sincere effort toward unity there?
I think Trump's prepared speeches are not indicative of what is going to happen in the future. I think that he conducts a State of the Union, kind of a state of the moment, every day on Twitter. We don't have to wonder what President Trump's desires and insecurities are. He's constantly telling us.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's sincere. If you want to hear a State of the Union address for bipartisanship that has credibility, listen to Charlie Baker talk once a year. I think if we compare national politics to state politics, it is a useful contrast.
That's a really interesting point. And actually, we're going to talk about Baker's testimony in Washington a little bit later. But I want to stick with this story, and that has to do with Senator Elizabeth Warren. More than a month after announcing an exploratory committee for president, tomorrow she's going to make it official and announce that she is running for president. It's not surprising. She'll be in Lawrence. We understand that Congressman Joe Kennedy III is going to introduce her and endorse her. But in spite of this, she can't seem to shake this controversy around her claims of Indian ancestry. This week, the Washington Post uncovered a registration card for the State Bar of Texas from 1986 on which she identified herself as American Indian. Then she had to sort of continue this apology tour. Here she is speaking this week to CNN.
This was about 30 years ago, and I am not a tribal citizen. Tribes and only tribes determine citizenship. I am not a member of a tribe, and I have apologized for not being more sensitive to that distinction. It's an important distinction.
So, Ed Lyons, what do you hear, or what's your view of this sort of situation that Elizabeth Warren finds herself in around this issue? She can't seem to shake it.
No, it reminds me of Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign, where she just couldn't shake the narrative about, you know, what was happening next with the email story, where there were incremental developments that were not really a significant contribution to the initial disclosure. So I think that Hillary Clinton was unable to come up with a narrative or persona that would transcend that. I think Senator Warren is having a really hard time changing the subject to something that's more substantial. So I think while I don't agree with the media endlessly hammering on the story, I do think that also Senator Warren has to show everybody that she can provide something better for the media to talk about.
Yeah, interesting. Do you agree with that, Susan? I mean, this does feel like one of those stories where I get the sense that the public probably doesn't care about it as much, and yet here we are talking about it. There was Elizabeth Warren being chased around the Capitol with a bunch of cameras. What's your take on what's going on here?
You know, if Ed looked at my notes in front of me, he'd see it's Hillary Clinton emails. I agree with that. It's an issue that in the scheme of what Elizabeth Warren has accomplished and what she's done in her life, this doesn't seem like it should be what defines her. But right now it is. And, you know, all campaigns have really hard things that they have to get through. There's no candidate who runs for an office who doesn't have a challenge. This is a real challenge for her and her ability to, I think, get past it and pick herself up from this is critical to her future in this campaign.
And we should stress as well in terms, I mean, it seems like the big sort of question which has been examined and talked about is, did this benefit her in some way? We know the Boston Globe did an exhaustive investigation, looked at her career, and there wasn't any evidence that they could find, that the reporters for the Boston Globe could find, that she actually benefited from this. So, Ed Lyons, why does this continue to be such a big deal?
I just think that it's been talked about her for so long, it's like a stain she can't get out. But I still think I don't want to blame her for this, but it's her job to transcend this. I remember hearing about this 7 years ago when Scott Brown put it out there. I cannot believe that 7 years later still talking about this story. I would really hope that the media sort of recognizes that the public benefit to these stories has really diminished and that Senator Warren finds a way to change the conversation. I think it's the media and Senator Warren have to find a way to get beyond this.
So, Susan, you know what? It strikes me there's a real kind of contrast when you compare this kind of issue surrounding Elizabeth Warren with what the president has survived. I mean, the Hollywood access tapes, all kinds of allegations of any number of things, from financial improprieties to allegations of sexual assault, on and on and on. And yet Elizabeth Warren seems stuck in this little question of, well, you know, a little awkward that you said you wanted to bring up this issue about your Native American heritage.
You're absolutely right. It really is mind-boggling how much time she has to spend answering this question. The one thing I would say is when Donald Trump is charged with all of these things, he so doesn't care. And in some ways, it's an odd message, but I find myself thinking that, not that Elizabeth Warren shouldn't care, but I feel like instead of apologizing, she just has to find a way to acknowledge, I screwed up, and move on. I think the more you try to get forgiveness over and over again, I think it just digs deeper and deeper. I think she needs to move on.
Well, she turns the page tomorrow. She announces her candidacy to run for president officially, and off she goes to New Hampshire, then Iowa. We'll see where this story goes. Ed, Susan, stay with us. We're going to take a break, but we're going to come back after about a minute. We're going to continue with our week in review. Listeners, we'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. We're back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're continuing our week in review conversation with Susan Tracy, the president of the Democratic consulting firm, The Strategy Group, and Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and a political writer. And we were speaking before the break about President Trump's State of the Union address earlier this week. One of the issues that was conspicuously absent from his address, climate change. But yesterday, two Democrats, New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey, introduced an extremely ambitious resolution called the Green New Deal.
Our energy future will not be found in the dark of a mine, but in the light of of the sun.
We should do it because we are a country founded on ideals of a culture that is innovative, that cares for our brothers and sisters across this country. We should do it because we are an example to the world.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, and before that, Ed Markey of Massachusetts. Whether they can do it, passing the Green New Deal is still very much up in the air, subject of debate. Susan Tracy, what did you hear in that introduction this week of the Green New Deal?
Strategically, I think it's brilliant. There are no real details to it, so there's nothing to really solidly come out and attack. It's oddly generational because it really speaks to young people. And at the same time, we were talking about a New Deal, which speaks to older people at the same time. They've reached out and made it much more about infrastructure and labor and jobs and farmers and created, I think, a diversity of constituency for it. And I think it's a mobilizing issue. No one has been able to really get traction on climate change politically. Externally, you have, you know, from Al Gore's on out. But to actually have within Congress a discussion, I give them credit for starting the conversation. As you know, where you start isn't where you end. But if you don't start, you don't end.
Ed Lyons, where do you see this going?
It sounded ridiculous to me. I understand Donald Trump has convinced a lot of people that you don't need policy knowledge or experience. But are we really going to let a 29-year-old congresswoman who's been in office for 35 days and bragged about being a waitress 3 years ago redesign the entire American economy? I think I'd rather take the climate thinking of our 62-year-old governor who's been in office for 4 years and been a policy guy his whole life. I have no problem with it as like a New Year's resolution. I'm going to lose 50 pounds and climb Mount Everest and get a better job. It's fine as a statement of ideas and direction, but as a piece of legislation, I mean, it's so many ideological fantasies all in one place. I really don't understand it.
Interesting.
I feel differently on it. I feel like it's a way to get people to focus on doing something on climate change. And if you don't, I always say the ends define the middle. And I feel like, you know, they're creating a conversation. And Ed Markey's been around a long time. He's not a 29-year-old, or 30-year-old member of Congress. He's been a longtime advocate on climate change and on doing the right thing environmentally. I give him credit.
So I'm going to split the difference here between you two because, well, let me set it up this way. So it is hugely ambitious, this idea. It aims to have the U.S. carbon neutral within 10 years, upgrading all existing buildings, overhauling transportation systems, and just to round it all off, guarantee a job with a family, sustaining income and quality health care for all Americans. So here's Ernest Moniz. He's President Obama's energy secretary. He was President Obama's energy secretary. He spoke with NPR's All Things Considered. He said absolutely in favor of a Green New Deal. But he had trouble with this one as overly ambitious.
I'm afraid I just cannot see how we could possibly go to zero carbon in a 10-year time frame. It's just impractical. And if we start putting out impractical targets, we may lose a lot of key constituencies who we need to bring along to have a real low carbon solution on the most rapid time frame that we can achieve.
So, Susan, when I hear that, it sort of made me go, yeah, maybe he's right. Maybe reaching too far is a way of, losing some of those key constituencies that he says we need to bring along.
Legislators inherently find compromise and a way to work together.
Right.
And when you work in a legislative body, you're going to have people who are on the right, the left, and in the middle. And if someone can jumpstart a conversation on the left, as long as they're savvy enough to recognize what ultimately they want to do, is achieve things, and that they're not like Donald Trump with the wall, that they understand how to move, beginning a conversation and beginning a dialogue to try to get something to happen, in my opinion, is a good thing.
Hmm. Well, let's stick with climate change. And Ed Lyons, you brought up Governor Charlie Baker a little while ago. He was in Washington to testify at a hearing on climate change held by the House Natural Resources Committee. Here's a bit of what he said in his opening remarks.
In Massachusetts, climate change is not a partisan issue. While we sometimes disagree on specific policies, we understand the science and know the impacts are real because we're experiencing them firsthand. The magnitude of the impacts from climate change requires all of us at the federal, state, and local levels to work together.
Now, during this hearing, there was an interesting exchange between Baker and California Republican Congressman Tom McClintock, who cited the failure of two wind turbines in Falmouth, Massachusetts, pushing back against Baker. So here's McClintock.
That small town went deeply into debt to finance them. The townspeople couldn't bear the noise, the constant flickering light as 400-foot windmills turned. Property values plunged 20%.
So here's how Baker responded to that, acknowledging that there were some problems with the project. But here's what he said.
Sometimes when something doesn't go the way it should go, everybody blames the concept. Well, sometimes we just screw up the way we actually implement it.
So, Ed Lyons, what did you hear in that exchange? And what did you make of Charlie Baker down there as a sort of reasonable, moderate voice tackling climate change and the way he's doing it?
Well, I guess it's easier to have a plan with no implementation of the Green New Deal than actually favor something that has to get built somewhere, isn't it? So I'm very glad our governor went down there. I think it's wonderful. I think he's building on existing mechanisms we have to deal with climate change in terms of fuel efficiency, in terms of using planning tools to incorporate climate change and resilience, talking about having our disaster relief programs become proactive in terms of preventing things from happening. I think that he's building on what we have and moving forward is better than some pipe dream that may never actually get passed. I think I prefer his approach to what was happening with Democrats in Congress right now.
All right. Well, listen, we've got to move on to our hubbubs. Otherwise, we're going to run out of time. Those are those stories that fell below the fold, but we still want to mention. Ed, let me start with you. What was your hubbub this week?
My hubbub was the 50th anniversary of Boston City Hall, the ugly, brutalist building where our city government is housed. I'm impressed that its undesirability and the emptiness of the plaza around has inspired government to produce great programming, to put daring art inside, to put things that honor different communities in there. I think the City Hall is a great symbol of a government transcending its limitations.
All right. Still ugly, but half a century old. Go ahead, Susan. What's your hubbub?
I'm going to go stay with the Patriots because it's been a fun week. And finally, today, on The Ellen Show today, Julian Edelman is going to have his beard shaved. And I felt like that was really worth talking about. He's going to give $10,000 to the Boys and Girls Club of Boston, as is The Ellen Show. And he looks a lot better because I hated that beard.
Yeah, that beard was scary. That beard was scary. Well, it is no longer. So my hubbub is also about the Patriots Super Bowl victory parade. And I want to cite an opinion piece in Commonwealth Magazine by James Aloisi, the former state secretary of transportation. He wrote a piece that was headlined, "Weekday Sports Victory Parades Have to Stop." He complains that Patriots Day parade day was also a day of transportation disruption, delay, discontent. He says inviting 1.5 million people into downtown Boston on a weekday puts unreasonable demands on our transit and rail system, that it causes delays, overcrowding, people relieving themselves in bottles, among other horrors, not to mention an enormous public cost, which he says the Patriots should bear. His solution, hold a parade on a weekend day when there are far less people trying to get to and from work. And he writes, if the Patriots want a parade, they should pay for the parade, every last penny of it. So I guess I want to say this to Jim Aloisi. Thanks for raining on our parade. but I think his suggestions are not unreasonable. So I just wanted, insofar as we made a big deal out of that parade here on WBUR, I just thought I would offer that other point of view.
Throw a beer can at him.
throw a beer can.
Buzz kill.
All right. Well, Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Ed, thanks so much for coming in. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And Susan Tracy, president and of the Democratic consulting firm, The Strategy Group. She was also a former state rep for Massachusetts. Susan, always great to have you.
Thanks, Anthony.
Have a great weekend. Listeners, stay with us. There's more ahead, including the great Chinese American food from Mei Mei. We're going to talk about a new cookbook.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. So how does this sound? Cranberry sage pork dumplings, or this? Roasted miso maple potatoes, Or how about this? Ginger scallion lobster rolls. Those are just some of the dishes featured in a new cookbook released just this week called Double Awesome Chinese Food, Irresistible and Totally Achievable Recipes from Our Chinese American Kitchen. The authors are Margaret, Irene, and Andrew Lee. They are the sibling co-owners of the Maymay Group, which is a Boston-based restaurant, a food truck, and a catering company. And joining me now in the studio are two of the three siblings, Andrew and Irene. Great to have you.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. I want to point out that Irene is also the head chef at Maymay, a 2018 James Beard finalist, and a food columnist for WBUR's Artery. So welcome to all of you, and thank you for coming in. And thank you for this book, and I want to ask you about it. The first sentence here is, let's start with the name Maymay. So let me start with you, Irene. Tell me about the name Maymay.
Well, Maymay means little sister in Mandarin Chinese, and so Andy was born first. He's our big brother, our Guga, and then Margaret was born second, a year later, and for a while, because Andy couldn't pronounce the word Margaret, they just called her May. And so Maymay was sort of her nickname for a long time. Then 8 years later, I came along and I sort of usurped the Maymay role, but the nickname stuck with her. When we were thinking about opening the food truck, we said to Andy, you know, we're happy to come back home and help you. You just have to name the business after us.
Nice. Well, I got to say, full disclosure, I'm a big fan of your restaurant, Maymay. Andrew, let me just get you to describe, what are you doing at Maymay? What's the food? How do you describe it?
So the food could be loosely interpreted as Chinese American. We like to characterize it as Chinese food with cheese. Often, you know, dairy is not a big part of traditional Chinese food, but it's something that we've incorporated in a lot of the dishes. And it's also really just our spin, our take on some classics, and adding the local ingredients as well. Whatever's available, we try to get those in the recipes.
So give me an example of that, Irene. Sort of Chinese-American with a local ingredient twist. I mean, talk about maybe one of your favorite recipes in this book.
Sure. Well, one of my favorite recipes is our cranberry sweet and sour pork. Cranberries, of course, classic to New England and Massachusetts. Not so common in Chinese cooking, but of course they have that great acidic punch, and that is perfect for a sweet and sour sauce, taking the place of some of the vinegar. And so that pork dish is like a really gorgeous version of what you might get for takeout from your corner Chinese restaurant.
So you have brought me, and I'm going to spare you and the listeners the sound of me slurping my way through this, but this is a fantastic dish that I have had, and it's your double awesome, right? So tell me about this. Why don't I get you, Andrew, to explain what the double awesome is? It's right in front of me. It's beautiful, but I want you to describe it.
Sure. So the double awesome is a grilled scallion pancake. We take two slow poached, then fried eggs, and put them in there with some house greens, local greens, house pesto, and some Cabot sharp cheddar cheese, and it's got the ooziness of the egg. You know, some brightness from the pesto and some of the sharpness from the cheese. We're very proud of this dish. It's our signature sandwich.
And don't forget the spicy ketchup.
Spicy ketchup. And you've cooked more than a couple of these along the way, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I did a rough calculation. I think I'm close to 50,000. I think that's a good good round number for me over the career.
So let me get a little background about your guys' family. What was it like? What were some of your favorite memories growing up around your family's kitchen, Irene? What role did food play in your home?
Well, I think the dinner table was really always the center of family life. Mom and dad both worked full-time as doctors, and so for all of us, getting together around the table for dinner was sort of when we would all get to really check in from the day. And one of my favorite memories, and this is a tradition we do every year, is after Thanksgiving, when we've eaten the turkey, we take all the bones and put them in a big pot, and we add rice and water, and we make a turkey stock rice porridge. And that's one of the first recipes in the book, and probably one of my favorites because it's so comforting. It's a humble sort of home-style dish, but there are lots of ways to sort of dress it up. And when we've served it in the restaurant, we find that people from all backgrounds really respond to it.
Really nice. Now, I'm interested, too. I want to talk more about the food, and there's some great examples in this beautiful cookbook. But I'm just intrigued, the three of you being in business together, what's that like? I'm looking through this cookbook. There are wonderful pictures of you guys. It looks like you adore each other. You're at the table together all the time. You're having wonderful meals together. Is it really that easy? Are you always in love with each other all the time?
That's definitely not the case. My sisters are very intelligent, very talented, but they came from a sort of a self-taught culinary background. My background was in corporate restaurants, so we didn't always agree on the right approach to things.
Oh, interesting. So give me an example of when you didn't agree.
It's hard for me to think of something specific right now, but just a lot of the, you know, the HR stuff, some of the marketing stuff, the way that we presented ourselves, you know, they had their own thoughts and way of dealing with things. So eventually I just decided that I wouldn't fight against it, and I capitulated. And that's kind of where we're at
Is
right
that
now.
Is that fair, Irene? He capitulated?
That
you guys,
about right.
You guys won? Yeah. That's great.
But, you know, I wouldn't have done it any other way.
All right. Well, that sounds great. Well, let's talk a little bit more about this food. There's a dish that's super intriguing. Red curry Frito pie. Yeah.
Yeah, so Frito pie is a sort of classic Tex-Mex and sometimes Midwestern dish. And basically, all you do is open up a bag of Fritos and pour some chili or some other delicious sort of stewy element over it, and maybe a little sour cream and cheese. And one of my earlier experiences with cooking was a friend who ran a Tex-Mex restaurant. So I fell in love with the format, and I'm so glad we included it in the book because it hopefully shows that we're not taking ourselves too seriously, right? Even though we're emphasizing, you know, sourcing and technique, sometimes you just want a bag of Fritos.
So so what's the Chinese or the Chinese American twist on this, on the Frito pie?
So the Frito pie has a little bit more of a Thai style twist. We also think of our food as being sort of multicultural Asian in some ways, the Asian pantry. And so Thai curry paste is one of the things that we always make sure we have in the fridge. It can turn, you know, vegetables or starch into something really punchy and delicious. And so it's a coconut milk based curry, and then you can really put anything you have in it. It could be ground beef or sweet potatoes or any number of veggies. So it really is a flavor profile that goes well with everything.
So the subheading here is irresistible and totally achievable recipes. So talk a little bit about some general tips that make these recipes totally achievable for home cooks. And I'll come back to you, Andrew.
Sure. So, you know, one tip that I would certainly offer is the cookbook is actually designed to progress through some of the more approachable recipes, such as the sauces. They're very versatile. You can kind of put them on everything. And it gets you into the more complex proteins and more complicated dishes toward the end. So building up confidence as you go is something that for me in particular, is very very helpful.
Right. And Irene, what about some just really useful tips that will sort of help demystify, I guess, this kind of cooking for people who might not immediately feel they know what they're doing?
Well, I think that a lot of the tips that are valuable are ones that we sort of picked up from getting into professional cooking. And a lot of them are less about cooking, actually, and more about just organizing and feeling confident and prepared in the kitchen. And I think that labeling things, setting up all your mise en place before you start cooking, those are things that help build that confidence and make it so that once you get the heat on under the pan, you know exactly what to do, and it all kind of flows from there. And of course, the first recipe in the book is just for white rice. And so we're sort of saying, you know, you can do this too. And I think that we also still think of ourselves as home cooks in many ways. And so making this something that made sense for a home kitchen, it doesn't require tons of fancy equipment or expensive ingredients, that was really important to us.
So interesting that you included a recipe for something as simple as white rice. So that sort of leads me to this question. What's the biggest sort of basic misunderstanding that people might have about this kind of food? This kind of food being Chinese American, Pan-Asian, whatever, you know, however broadly you want to define it.
That's a great question. I think for me, one thing that I sometimes take issue with is the phrase Asian fusion, because what we cook, and the way this book came together was much more organic and much less about fusion or, you know, something you would do in a lab. And it was really just about growing up Chinese and American in Boston. And so many of these recipes are not things that we thought down and sat down and thought about and said, you know, how can we make something that's both Chinese and American? It's just kind of what happened.
Yeah, it was just the food that was there in your home, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. So who was the cook, Andrew, when you were kids? Was it your mom? Was it your dad? Was it both of them?
That's a great question. Our parents both had medical backgrounds. So we kind of like to say that the restaurant industry bug skipped a generation with our folks and then hit us pretty hard. So we had various au pairs and nannies that lived with us, and they would do the cooking. Actually, incidentally, my favorite early childhood memory of cooking in the house was Wednesday night, which was always Prince Spaghetti Day.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
nice.
Yeah. So being a kid, that was what I look forward to.
That was a theme in my house only because my name was Anthony, right? Uh-huh. So, you know, that was always teased about Prince Spaghetti Day for that reason. What about dumplings? Dumplings seem to be this sort of central thing in so many kind of Asian families. Did they feature in a big way, Irene?
Dumplings are a big part of this cookbook, and definitely a big part of what our restaurant is all about. One of the reasons we love dumplings is because, as you say, they're multicultural. Every culture, whether it's Polish or Nepalese, has a version of some delicious thing wrapped in delicious starch. And so that was one of the ways that we sort of wanted to show our multicultural approach to food through a Chinese lens. Hmm. So in the book, we have a bunch of sort of non-traditional recipes for dumplings. We have some step-by-steps about how to make dumpling wrappers or where to buy them if you prefer to buy them. And I think that everyone can get excited about dumplings. And that's one of the things that is so great about teaching the classes we do and then having the menu items and the specials that we get to run.
Well, the book is Double Awesome Chinese Food, Irresistible and Totally Achievable Recipes from Our Chinese American Kitchen. The authors are Andrew, Irene, and Margaret Lee. And we've been talking to Andrew and Irene Lee. They're sibling co-owners of the May May Group, a Boston-based restaurant, food truck, and catering company. Thank you so much, both of you, for coming in.
Thank you.
A pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for bringing me the Double Awesome. I can't wait to tear into that as soon as we get off the air. Finally today, during our recent fundraisers here at WBUR, we've brought you samples of Last Scene, the investigative podcast from WBUR and the Boston Globe. It explores the mystery behind the world's largest unsolved art heist at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston almost three decades ago. If you haven't heard it, you can subscribe at WBUR.org/last scene. The show is hosted by reporter and senior producer Kelly Horan and reporter Jack Rodolico. Tonight, we're bringing you an episode that I love. Episode 6, a story about how to plot an art recovery and then blow it entirely.
It's not everybody who can recover stolen art. Having a tolerance for con men is helpful because you'll be spending a lot of time with them. You need to have patience, a lot of it, because these things take time. And you have to have both a knack for building trust and a comfort with destroying it.
You know, in every operation that an agent goes undercover, his main goal is to befriend and then betray. That's the whole point.
This is retired FBI art recovery agent Bob Whitman. He spent his entire career based in the Philadelphia Bureau, about two decades, befriending and betraying as a job description. It was all in the name of recovering hot art. By his reckoning, Whitman has gotten back some $300 million worth of art and cultural property. Geronimo's eagle feather headdress, a ring with a lock of George Washington's hair in it, and precious artifacts thought to be lost forever.
Including documents such as an original copy of the Bill of Rights that was stolen by a Union trooper in 1865 from the state of North Carolina.
But the most valuable and elusive art that Whitman says he was this close to recovering was stolen from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in 1990. So what happened? And why does Whitman's story leave us wondering if the Boston FBI was the reason the Gardner art slipped away?
Our story begins in 2006 with Bob Whitman, undercover, befriending a pair of French gangsters with ties to a murderous Corsican gang.
The actual information was that they had paintings that were stolen two decades ago from a museum in the United States. And one of the paintings was a Vermeer and the other was a Rembrandt.
The Vermeer really piqued Whitman's interest because at the time, there was only one missing, the concert. In Miami, Whitman adopted the persona of a shady art dealer in the market for stolen masterpieces. He called himself Bob Clay, and he began to spend a lot of time with two Frenchmen. One was named Sonny, the other Lorenz.
Lorenz was a French national who was living in Miami. He had done well in the real estate business. Drove a Rolls Royce. He had his hair well coiffed. He went and got facials. He had his nails done on a regular basis. Sonny was the exact opposite. Sonny was short, very squat, all muscle from the neck to the waist, but he had a big waist. He was heavy. He had a haircut. What do they call those? The long in the back and short in the front.
A mullet?
Mullet, yeah.
Both men, Lorenz, well-coiffed, and Sonny, rocking a mullet, had serious criminal records back in France. Sonny's rap sheet included charges like theft, drug trafficking, aggravated assault. Lorenz was allegedly on the run from charges for financial fraud.
Yeah, in the end, we found that the Lorenz was basically more like a mob accountant, whereas Sonny was more like the hired muscle.
Whitman, posing as Bob Clay, spent months cultivating their trust. As he did, he says he grew increasingly persuaded that Sonny and Lorenz held the keys to getting the stolen paintings out of France, where they were allegedly held in the hands of that Corsican gang.
It was a gambit that could have cost all of them their lives. Those Corsicans were stone-cold killers. In order for his Operation Masterpiece, as the FBI called it, to succeed, Whitman had to secure Sonny and Lorenz's unwavering trust. One day, the three men met in a Miami cafe.
And Sonny said, okay, we're going to do this operation, but we're going to have to set this up in a triangle. And he took a little piece of tissue or a napkin, and with a pen he wrote a triangle. And he said, this is a closed triangle. It's just the three of us. This is a triangle of trust. If anything happens, we'll know it's one of us with the informant.
As Sonny drew his triangle of trust, he wrote each man's initials in each corner. B, L, and S. Bob, Lorenz, Sonny. Three strangers pledging their trust to each other and to one goal, an art sale. But not just any art sale, a $30 million black market swap of cash for two stolen masterpieces. Whitman and other former federal officials we spoke with say this was the best lead the FBI ever had in the Gardner case. They also say that Bob Whitman was hands down the best, the only man for the job. No one else had his background, his eye, or his expertise.
And Whitman says he's been an art lover since he was a kid. He grew up in Baltimore, and his parents met during the Korean War when his dad was stationed on an Air Force base in Japan.
That's where he met my mother, married my mother, who was Japanese, working on the base, and he fell in love with all things Japanese at that point. And I grew up around these antiques. When other people were throwing footballs in the house, I was looking at Japanese Satsuma and Kutani ceramics and looking at Yukio-e prints.
After the war, his dad opened three antique stores, and it was in these stores that Whitman learned how to buy and sell art, skills that would later serve him well. He started at the FBI's Philadelphia office in 1988. Back then, there wasn't really a job designed for an aspiring art cop.
Art theft back in 1988 was considered the same as any type of property crime. It didn't matter if it was a Chevrolet or a Monet. It was the same. So there was no professionalism involved in how to do an art theft investigation in 1988 when I started.
Over time, Whitman gravitated to cases that spoke to his love of art and antiquities. He linked up with Assistant U.S. Attorney Bob Goldman, who helped him find legal avenues to pursue cases of stolen art. Goldman says Whitman solved bigger and bigger art crimes because he was so smooth undercover.
Even knowing he's an FBI agent, I would buy heroin from him,
because he was able to sweet talk you. And he did it with dignity. He used to keep pictures of some of the guys that he used to arrest. And he'd have pictures of himself and the guys smiling and shaking hands at the time of the arrest. I mean, they actually liked him.
One of Whitman's bosses, Eric Ives, a retired FBI supervisor, says Whitman's successes helped convince the FBI that they should be doing more to solve art crimes.
Bob Whitman, in a football analogy, was the quarterback. He had the experience and expertise, and unusual to many programs, Bob not only had the art expertise, but he also was an undercover agent. So it was a rare opportunity for us to take advantage of his skill set. And so he was the thinker or the creator of the idea to create an art crime team.
Whitman's work relied on a basic truism of art crime. Stealing the stuff is easy. Selling it is the hard part.
These individuals are not always well-versed in the business of art. If they were, they wouldn't have stolen what they stole. I mean, there's no way you're going to steal a Rembrandt from the Swedish National Museum and be able to sell it on any kind of market.
Bob Whitman would know. He's the one who recovered that $35 million Rembrandt. He bought it in a dingy Danish hotel room in 2005 from an Iraqi criminal who was promptly arrested after the sale. When Whitman went undercover, he never wore disguises. He didn't use fake accents. He had a rule.
Try to keep everything as true as possible. In other words, you don't have to remember the truth. So remembering lies is much more difficult than just remembering the truth.
Whitman might have been posing as a shady dealer, but he told the truth about where he grew up, how many kids he had, and what kind of art he liked. And he always used his first name, ensuring he would react naturally, like the time he met a criminal carrying a stolen item in an airport.
And as we walked through the airport, there was someone there who actually knew me, a neighbor, and who said, "Hello, Bob." And it was perfect. So my response was, "Hey, how you doing, Jeff?" And we kept walking.
Does an unplanned moment like that sort of deepen your credibility in a criminal's mind, right? When they see you, it's sort of being vouched for.
It's a possibility, but I can tell you for a fact, moments like that are terrifying, and they make your rear end slam shut because of the moment that you might be found out.
One of those moments came when Whitman watched in horror as some fellow undercover FBI agents went too far.
Talk about the strawberry eating contest.
No, I don't want to talk about that.
Really?
Yeah.
Even though it's in the book and you've talked about it already?
Yeah, I don't like talking about that. Yeah, I don't want to talk about strawberries.
Whitman doesn't want to talk about the strawberry incident, but we can because he wrote about it in his memoir. In 2007, the FBI rented a yacht in Miami for a party. The kind of party a black market art dealer like Whitman's alias Bob Clay might attend. Other than the criminals, Sonny and Lorenz, everybody on the yacht was FBI. The captain, Colombian drug dealers, and their bikini-clad wives, all agents. Whitman haggled with a fake drug lord over the price of some presumably stolen paintings. In fact, they were FBI stock forgeries of works by Salvador Dali and Georgia O'Keeffe. All of this was for the benefit of Sonny and Lorenz, so they could see Whitman, a.k.a. Bob Clay, in action. Whitman played his role, but he says the other agents on the yacht overacted theirs. The drug dealer wives suggested a strawberry eating contest. Then, to Whitman's dismay, they got down on their knees and started sucking whipped cream off the strawberries, and they designated Sonny the judge. Whitman wrote, quote, "It didn't play right, the chubby, lowest-ranking guy in our gang getting the royal treatment. Sonny fidgeted uncomfortably. Once again, our investigation was veering dangerously off course." Whitman thought that was bad enough. What came next threatened to derail the entire operation.
Quite the cliffhanger. That's from episode 6 of Last Scene, the investigative podcast from WBUR and the Boston Globe. It features reporter Jack Rodolico and reporter and senior producer Kelly Horan from WBUR, with contributions from Boston Globe Spotlight reporter Steve Kirkchin. To subscribe and hear the full episodes, including the second half of episode 6, you can head to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and search Last Scene. That's S-E-E-N. That's our program for today and this week. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend and join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.